You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening and welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. The Library Foundation of Los Angeles is instrumental in supporting many programs in Los Angeles, programs at the Los Angeles Public Library, from homework help to college prep to Read Baby Read. The list is long. And the programs are vital in giving access and support to Angelenos across this vast city. This evening, this season, we have focused on resilience, and we also will be focusing on it this evening. And we picked this idea for many reasons. Most importantly, it spoke to how all of us have had to be resilient in order to survive these last 2 years. We've adjusted our daily lives in order to deal with the constant challenges and the acute realities that we've had to face. The freedom that we've had to read has been one of the many safe havens, a saving grace for many of us. Books allow us to learn and dream and escape into a world that may not be the one we're living in, or maybe the one that we do inhabit, but not the one that we know. Tonight, the celebrated writer Nazar Nafisi will discuss her new book, Read Dangerously, The Subversive Power of Literature in Troubled Times. As Nafisi says, we need the truth that fiction offers us. In her book, she addresses the power that literature has to oppose the weight of oppression. She closely looks at difficult topics like truth, empathy, and racial injustice by examining the writings of several writers, including Plato, Toni Morrison, Salman Rushdie, and Margaret Atwood, among others. Before I introduce our guests, I need to quote Nafisi once more. Quote, I really believe that books might not save us from death, but they help us live. Azar Nafisi has written 5 books. Her first book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir in books, won multiple awards and spent over 117 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Nafisi has taught at Oxford and multiple universities in Tehran. She comes to us this evening from Washington, D.C. She will be in conversation with Jeffrey Brown, a Peabody award-winning senior correspondent and chief arts correspondent for PBS NewsHour. In addition, he hosts a monthly book club, Now Read This, a collaboration between PBS NewsHour and the New York Times. It is my great pleasure to introduce Azar Nafisi and Jeffrey Brown. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you. Well, thank you for having us. Thank you, Jessica. Hello, Azar. How are you?
Oh, Jeff. Fine. Yourself?
I'm good. I think I'm going to tell everybody our little secret. First of all, we appreciate all of you joining us here. And our secret is we're good friends. We're old friends. And we've been having these kind of conversations for a long time with our spouses and friends, usually with a bottle of wine, right, Azar?
At least one bottle.
But this is a little different.
An ice cream for dessert.
I also, just before we start, I want to say how pleased I am just to be doing this, any library, because we both love libraries, and B, the Los Angeles Public Library in particular. I myself was last there to talk to Susan Orlean for her book, The Library Book, and I know that library very well. And Azar, before we started this, you were saying you had some nice memories there too, right?
I had some nice memories of Los Angeles Public Library. For my previous books, each time I had the book, I gave a talk at that library, and the warmth of it and the beauty has stayed with me. So I'm very glad to be back and to be back here with you.
So we're going to talk for about 45 minutes or so. And, I've got a lot of questions and some structure, but because we've been having these conversations for a while and because I know you, we'll just sort of see where things go and, try to get to as many topics as we can, both in the book and especially how they pertain to what's happening today. And we'll save some time for questions. Please throw your questions into our chat as you have them, and I'll see if I can get them into our conversation early on, if not at the end. But Azar, I think we need to start. I mean, we can't ignore the moment we're in with Ukraine. So I think we might as well just go there right away and then sort of back our way into some of the broader type issues. We meet at a moment like this. I put it in personal terms. How does it change the way you think? How does it change the way you live at the moment? How does it change the way you read?
Well, you know, Jeff, these days I keep thinking of this, what Henry James during World War I, that he opposed a great deal, wrote to a friend of his. He said, in resistance against the war, feel all you can. And that is how I feel right now about Ukraine, that we have to go there with our hearts and we need to empathize. And that's why we need fiction, because we need to empathize and put ourselves in their shoes in another way. The other thing that these days I keep thinking about as I watch television news and the horrible war that is going on, is that we should once and for all realize that supporting democracy in other parts of the world is not an act of philanthropy. That what happens in a country thousands of miles away from us with the people whom we have never seen, whose language we don't speak, what happens to those people and how they live will directly and indirectly affect us and how we live. And the last thing is that Ukraine is showing us that even in extreme circumstances, like a war as brutal as this one, we try not to become like our enemy. We try to be different from them. Putin kills children, kills families, destroys cities. What do Ukrainians do apart from defending their towns, their cities, and themselves? They call the mothers of captured Russian soldiers and tell them to come and collect their sons. That is how we differentiate from our enemies. We do not become like them. It is so easy to become like them. And so the war in Ukraine teaches us a great deal.
You know, for you, you write a book, any book, you write it and the world is the way it is. It's at a given moment. And then the book comes out at a moment like this and the world is suddenly quite different.
Yes.
And I know you're doing a lot of talking about the book, but I wonder if it changed the whole, you know, meaning of the book in some way, the context of the things that you're writing about, even this notion of reading dangerously at this particular moment.
Well, you know, actually, in a very strange way, the situation right now brought out some hidden aspects of the book that I hadn't thought about, you know.
Like what?
Well, one was this dealing with the enemy. Because I had talked about it more, well, not exactly theoretically. I mean, in the Islamic Republic, especially, I had the experience of having to deal with someone I would call enemy. But this war took me to such extremes. And while I was not involved with it, I could experience the, you know, it was so easy for the Ukrainians to go another way, to either give in and say, we can't do anything, or become as brutal as the Russians were, and they refused to do both. That was one hidden aspect of the book. Another one that I mention in the third chapter of my book, because actually that third chapter is about war, mm-hmm. and all the writers in that chapter have experienced war and conflict in one way or another, is the idea that, you know, I can't even talk about it. There is the extreme polarization and extreme dehumanization. I mean, demonization that you see and the lies that you see. Yeah. And the way we need to humanize not just those who are our allies, but we need to humanize our enemies. Mm-hmm. And in that chapter, I ask a question which I ask now of everyone who reads this book. How do we live decently in indecent times? Because that is the main question. Not just that this war might kill us, physically annihilate us, but how could we keep our dignity as human beings and not to give in to the indecencies that are happening all around us all the time in different forms?
You know, the title of the book, Read Dangerously, I think, because you cite it, you're taking this from the work Create Dangerously,
yeah,
by Edwige Danticat, a book, beautiful book that I know very well from reading and interviewing her for the NewsHour some years ago, in which she thinks very hard about the role of the artist, particularly the immigrant or refugee artist, who in some ways lives in two countries. And you used the quote from her, create dangerously for people who read dangerously. So there's your title. Define for us what you mean by reading dangerously. What does that mean?
Well, I think that all great books are dangerous in a sense. James Baldwin talks about artists are here to disturb the peace. And this is what great fiction does for us. It disturbs our peace. Now, reading dangerously, I felt that since I returned to United States, I felt that we had become too complacent, too comfortable. You know, this word comfortable we keep using, and especially in relation to books, reading a book makes us uncomfortable, disturbs us, as if that is a bad thing. While knowledge is disturbing. Knowledge tells you things about not just the world, but about yourself, which you might not like to know. And so I wanted to talk about reading dangerously as the kind of reading that where you go into a book without any presuppositions, where you go into a book without saying, does it confirm me? Is it about me? Is it about what I want it to be? And say, what am I going to find there? It is that innate curiosity that makes us human, that makes us want to know others. And in order to know others, then we need empathy, because we need to go under their skin. We need to experience them. And fiction allows us to experience others who are not like us. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it can be very dangerous. No wonder tyrants want to kill writers and to jail and harass and censor them and readers too, actually.
Yeah.
So that is what I meant by reading dangerously.
So you've written this in a very interesting way. I mean, you could have written it in a kind of straightforward nonfiction or in essays, but you've written in a series of letters to your father, now deceased. Explain that structure first, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the particular letters.
Okay, well, you know, with this book especially, I have this problem with every book where I don't want to just write straight essays.
Yeah.
But I have some ideas that I need to explain and express. So finally, I always go to narrative. But this time, it wasn't just narrative. There was a feeling inside me that needed to come out. And so I needed to address someone who was intimate to me. Mm-hmm. At first, I was writing letters to everyone, like Saul Bellow's Herzog. I even wrote a letter to Donald Trump because I was so angry, you know.
Oh, I'm sure he would have loved that.
He would. He loves my letters.
Yeah,
and
sure.
He loves my books. I mean, you know, we have this thing going, and so but these letters were random. You know, they weren't going anywhere. So then I started writing to the writers that I had chosen, but that was artificial. What did I know of these writers? Nothing. And I was talking to a friend and she told me, why don't you write about a third person? And immediately my father came to my mind because I had this relationship with my father since I was 3.5 years old, where he would tell me stories. Mm-hmm. And later on, this relationship, as I grew up, developed into having conversations. Even when he was angry at me, he wouldn't tell me, I'm angry at you. What are you? Why did you do this? He would say, there was this guy who had this daughter whom he loved so much, but the daughter did yada, 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 you know. So we found the common language through stories where we talked about our most intimate things, as well as ideas, books, people. When I was 4 years old, he wrote his first address to me in his diary. He addressed me and talked about himself and talked about the future. So I felt he was the right person for me to write these letters to.
Well, so you should tell everyone about him, because there's not only the intimacy of being your father in the father-daughter relationship, but he was a very public man himself, deeply involved in the issues of his time, the conflicts of his time, all kinds of things that resonate very much to today. So in that sense, he was the right person to write to as well. Tell everybody about him.
Well, you know, actually, at the end of my book, in the appendix, I have his letter to Lyndon Johnson. He was very much taken by the idea of the Great Society. And so he wrote this open letter to Johnson about his ideas of America. He was very involved with America somehow. You know, and he talks about racism and poverty and the contradictions within the country, which is so prosperous and so free, and at the same time, so not prosperous and free. He was also the youngest mayor of Tehran. He was a good mayor. He was one of the most popular mayors that Tehran has had. He was not a good politician. He subverted his own position in society, and he stood up to the prime minister and to minister of interior, who were very powerful in Iran, and they concocted some charges against him and put him in what they called the temporary jail. And they told him that if he apologizes and regrets what he has been doing up to then, they will let him out. They won't have any quarrels with him. And he said that he wanted to stay in jail and have his day in court, that he wanted to defend himself and be exonerated. And so he stayed in jail for 4 years before finally they didn't know what to do with him. So they had a trial. And he was exonerated of all charges. At the beginning, he was exonerated of all charges except the charge of insubordination. And I loved it. I thought that was so marvelous. Insubordination. But unfortunately, they also took that away. They said, you know, he's exonerated of that crime as well. Mm-hmm. So that was my father's foray into politics, but he was more of a poet, and he wrote a great deal of poetry. He wrote poetry for his grandchildren, as well as writing children's books and translating La Fontaine's fables for first my brother and I, and then our children.
But that meant that with your father leading this public life, you, as a child, were aware of the sort of larger political world as well as the books he was reading to you.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm wondering as I listen to that, this idea coming back to reading dangerously. I know everybody who's read your books knows you've been reading forever, and that you yourself read with danger at a certain point in your life. Did you always see reading as something that had a kind of, I'll use your word, had a danger to it, had a way to force you to see the world differently?
You know, I've always felt that reading makes me look at the world through the alternative eyes of imagination. So in that way, it changes me because I don't see the ordinary life around me the way I would have seen it had I not read these books. In that sense, it was reading dangerously. But, I always read. I mean, that is how I connected. When I was sent to England at the age of 13, I was devastated. I mean, everything that I learned at that age, that everything that you love and cherish can be taken away from you at the drop of an eyelid, you know. But what remained with me was the best that Iran could offer. I brought with me three books, two by our classical poets, Hafez and Rumi, and the third one by a feminist poet, Furugh Farrokhzad. And I took them with me, and at nights I would read them. And that is how I took Iran in my portable world. I mean, books became my portable home. And I connected to England and later to America through books, through reading Dickens and Austen and Auden and later Melville and Ellison and, Emily Dickinson. They became my cousins and siblings and uncles and aunts and books and but I found the dangerous quality of books really when I went back to the Islamic Republic of Iran. Mm-hmm. There I realized how tyrannical mindsets feel threatened by the freedom that reading offers us and the truth that it reveals to us, because they are the fabricators of lies, and literature is all about revealing the truth, and these two don't go together.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit then, because one thing that you make clear from the very beginning and in the introduction is there are different kinds of dangers to reading and writing. In a totalitarian regime, there is one kind of danger, which you, as you say, the regime pays too much attention to poets and writers, harassing, jailing, even killing them. So let's start there, because you just were talking about what happened when you experienced that in Iran yourself. The tyrant sees and understands the power of books, right? It's a kind of strange thing. You're saying they give it almost too much power to the poets and writers.
They do. I mean, and you have it since the time of Plato. Mm-hmm. I mean, as opposed to the hierarchical society that he creates and the noble lie that he uses in order to keep everyone in space, he exiles the poet. He doesn't want Homeric poet there because the poet is unruly. You never know what is going to come next. Mm-hmm. Because poetry is ambiguous and contradictory and full of paradoxes. And tyrannical mindsets cannot tolerate that. They cannot, they feel weak because they don't know what language to speak to the poet. Mm-hmm. And the only language they know is that of elimination. That is why I discovered when I was living in the Islamic Republic that these people who have so much power are really really, in essence, powerless. Their violence comes from their utter fear, fear of others who are different from them. And it is obvious that one of their first targets become poets and writers, you know. It is just natural that they would do that. And they use guns because they cannot use words properly.
But it's still interesting when you compare it, and we'll talk a little bit later about democracies like our own and the dangers of reading and writing. But in staying with a totalitarian type of regime, and thinking of Iran or many other places, that the government, the rulers, give that power, see that power to the poet and the writer, because to some degree the poet and the writers actually have it, right? I mean, in your youth and where in the kind of setting you were growing up with, you talked about those three books you brought with you to London and then to the U.S. But people knew their poets, right?
Yes. Yes. Actually, one of the amazing things about Iran is the way they treat their poets. My father used to tell me that this country is ancient and it has been invaded so many times. But what gives us as Iranians identity? What makes us... gives a thread throughout Iran's history is its poetry. And that is how Iranians identify. I mention it in my book that when the revolution happened, the new rulers brought down the statues of the king and changed the names of the streets from the ones that had the names of the royal family. Then they came to destroy the statue of our epic poet Ferdowsi, who lived 1,000 years ago and wrote this book in protest, in fact, against the Arab invasion of Iran, and talks about the ancient mythology of Iran. They wanted to bring that statue down and change the name of the street that was named after Omar Khayyam, who was agnostic and an astrologer. People did not let them do that. They could bring down the king, but they couldn't bring down the poet. And I remember the quotation from Vladimir Nabokov saying, governments come and go. Only the trace of genius remains. And of course, Shakespeare talks about this. Ferdowsi himself talks about how as poets, they will remain, but the tyrants will not remain.
So you have that on the one hand, and then your other theme in this book is an irregular theme that you talk and write about, is the different kind of danger to reading and writing in a democracy such as our own. So you say the problem in America is that too little attention is paid to poets and writers. They are silenced not by torture and jail, but by indifference and negligence. So this is a very different sort of reading dangerously, or danger to reading.
Yes, because one of our pastimes these days in America has become to avoid pain at any cost. And we begin with books, then we come to real life. But the question is, if we cannot tolerate pain in a book, if we need trigger warnings for them, then how do we tolerate pain or stand up to pain in real life? Are we going to evade it there? Evasion from imagination always is accompanied by evasion from reality. And, I love this quote by Ray Bradbury. He says, you don't have to burn books to destroy a culture. All you have to do is to get the people not to read books. And that is what I see as danger in the United States. It doesn't come from jail. It does come from censorship and banning books, and it also comes from our indifference. That is why I think every library, every school, every bookstore should have their subversive books, book groups, and read these bloody banned books, you know, and discuss them and not let books die.
How do you see this playing into our politics, our divided politics? Because it's not, I mean, sometimes the book bans recently are clearly tied to those. We can talk, let's talk a little bit more about that. But generally in these last 5 years, 10 years, as the divisions in the culture have grown and in our politics, it's not usually a discussion around books, you know, or books explicitly. But how do you make the tie?
It is a discussion around a viewpoint, I mean, a vision. And books become part of that, you know. It is, in fact, a discussion around democracy, whether we want to have multivocality, because that is one thing about fiction. By structure, fiction is democratic. It gives voice to every character, including the villain. Everyone has the right to speak, and it does not lean on judgment, but it leans on understanding. Mm-hmm. So it gives you the experience of each of these characters, and you decide. You have a choice to decide, rather than the writer to tell you which point to choose. A bad writer would do that, would give you a message. But a good writer, a great writer, lets you be free and make your own choice. And that is what I see is happening in the United States. It is part of the fighting against banning of books or censorship of books today, or trying to make our system of education keep on being a liberal kind of education with a free market of ideas. All of that is part of the larger struggle for democracy. I think they all come together. Baldwin used to say, ignorance plus power is the most pernicious enemy of justice. And I think that the fight is over knowledge as a whole in our universities today. And God save us from our own follies by not paying attention.
I mean, you know, of course, there's a long history of book bans or book review, books taken out of circulation, or certainly controversies over books in the country. Have you thought about why it's happening so feels so strong right now?
Well, it is now the time of such deep polarization. I mean, it's this polarization didn't happen overnight, of course. It has been happening gradually, only we didn't pay attention to it. And this is the time when totalitarian trends come to the fore, where you do not want to hear, you do not want to listen to others, not just your adversaries or your enemies. You don't want to hear and listen to others. You have already defined others. And have categorized them and put them in separate boxes. And therefore, you don't need to know them. And actually, no coming from knowledge, that is what is threatening us today. And it leads to what Saul Bellow calls as the most important threat to the democracies, when he talks about the greatest threat is our sleeping consciousness and our atrophy of feeling. That is as dangerous as anything, any weapon.
You know, I want to challenge a little bit on that, because it's something I've been thinking about as I'm reading about the situations around the country and states and in local school districts. If you think about the changing demographics of the country, you think about the changes in the book publishing world, the books that are going into schools, and if you, as we're acknowledging and you're saying in your book, even the subtitle, the subversive power of literature, right? We're acknowledging that books have a subversive power. So if you're a parent of young children in a school district in anywhere in this country, do you not have a right to worry about the subversive nature of books coming into the school library?
Well, if...
What do you say to those parents?
Of course, I think that every parent has a right to say, I don't want my kid to read this book, but they don't have to write to say, I don't want any kid to read this book. Mm-hmm. But apart from that, I know what you're saying, but then what I claim, at least, and I might be wrong, that knowledge is subversive. That is
knowledge
why...
itself.
Yeah, knowledge by itself. That is why God forbids us from biting into the apple and eating from the tree of knowledge, because it is subversive. It takes the attention away from you and into others. Mm-hmm. And you look at yourself through the eyes of others. And you might not always like what you see. Literature becomes a mirror in which you discover yourself. It's not just discovering other people or discovering the world. And parents, in order to safeguard their children against quote unquote bad things, should want their children to be subverted. Children by nature are subversive themselves, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure you've had the same experience with your grandson. With my grandchildren, I'm looking at the world through their eyes, mm-hmm. and nothing is the way I thought it was, you know. Everything is different. And with imagination, the same process happens. You become a child again, and you dare going to places that your parents say, oh, be careful. You know, be careful you don't go there. But you go there and you come back healthy and wealthy and wise.
So let's actually talk a little bit about some of the authors, because your way in here is through authors you clearly admire, you've read deeply, and see them helping us all sort of look at life today. You write these letters, it's structured through the letters to your father. And each chapter is a long letter that takes on some specific writers. I want to talk about some of the specific writers, but first, is there something that they all share when you went back and read the whole thing? Did you see something that all these authors had?
Well, most of them, at least three of them I know, call themselves as writers, they call themselves as witnesses. That they tell that as a witness, they are obliged to tell the truth, mm-hmm. and to not remain silent. So that is one thing that they all have in common, that they don't remain silent. The other thing is that although almost all of them have been active in politics in one way or another, or in defense of human rights or anything like that, they consider themselves as writers, not activists. You know, as writers, their role is different from a political activist. You know, so their subversion is different. Their kind of subversion is very different. These are the two, and they all have lived in areas of conflict.
Mm-hmm. Well, some
more than the others, yeah. Some more than the others, but okay. All have experienced conflict in one way or another.
So we can't go through all of them, but pick a couple that, I mean, one who has lived in conflict, who I happen to love and have met also, is David Grossman, right? The Israeli novelist. Tell us a little, maybe you're introducing him more than some of these other names to our audience. Tell them why he's important, why we should.
Oh my God, I'm so much in love with To the End of Land that I like mm-hmm. being in love with some actual person. You don't know what to say, you know? I can say, I love it. But
what did you say to him when you met him? Did you say that? I'm in love with you, or I'm in love with your
book? No, I didn't. I felt very shy. And as I mentioned in the book, it's like telling parents that you love their son, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. I felt that, you know, I don't know if you feel about your writing, but you feel very close, I mean, like a parent, but also you know that you have to let go of the child. You know, and right. the child will go places that you never thought existed, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
So that is the way I feel. Grossman's son was killed in the war with in the Israeli Palestinian conflict. And he himself went to war, but he is very much anti-war. And he's very much anti-occupation of Palestinian lands. But his books are about Palestine and the conflict, but more importantly, they are about the individuals who have to live under these conditions. Mm-hmm. Rather than giving you the headline news, he goes into the mind and heart of these individuals and shows the need for humanization of the enemy. That is when Grossman was the first writer I read on this issue of how to deal with the enemy, because he is so adamant that he has to know the enemy, to write about the enemy, to read the enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, and he said that one of his most important experiences was when an Arab, and I think it was an Egyptian reviewer, reviewed his book. So he confirmed Grossman as an individual, as a human being. He mm-hmm. accepted him mm-hmm. as a human being, you know.
Yeah.
And but he, as a writer, he's a superb writer. He doesn't have messages in tow. He weaves in his vision into the characters of the novel, and they become very very alive, especially mm-hmm. the protagonist in that novel, that is a woman. I just say this and then finish it, because I can go on forever talking about the book. The main character, the protagonist, Aura, her son has gone to the battle, and she decides to walk through the land because she's worried that if she stays at home and they will come and notify her son's death, her son would be really dead. So she thinks by being away from the house, she would avoid his death. And she walks the land with her former lover and father of her son. And they tell one another stories. Mm-hmm. She tells him stories about the son, about himself. At the end, we don't know if the son lives or dies, but we know that through the stories, Aura has guaranteed his son's life, because he will always be alive through the stories.
All right. You know what? I'm starting to get some questions. We'll keep talking, but I'll ask them as they come here. Shireen asks, I wanted to ask, should we read your new book in sequence with your previous books? Or is it all right if we read Reading Dangerously first?
It is quite all right to read dangerous texts. They are related. I mean, they're like siblings, but they're very different siblings and they do different things. So whether you know the eldest first or the youngest, it won't make any difference.
But it's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, beyond whether she reads, which one she reads in order, because do you see yourself, do you see the connections between these books?
Yeah.
And what you and what you yourself are exploring over time.
Yeah. Well, because almost the ending of each book leads to the beginning of the other. But I mean, I have a question. Like in reading Lolita, at the end of reading Lolita in Tehran, I asked a question, paraphrasing Saul Bellow, that those who survive the ordeal of Holocaust, how will they survive the ordeal of freedom? And the ordeal of freedom was in Republic of Imagination, which is the story of my becoming an American. And I talk about creating dangerously in the epilogue of, and Baldwin is in the epilogue of Republic of Imagination. And then Baldwin becomes the last chapter again of this book. But they are really separate books. You won't have any problem not reading any of them or reading each of them.
All right, here's one from Hannah. You say that reading difficult stories makes us uncomfortable. Is it possible to find peace or acceptance through processing and exploring these difficult stories? Now, that's an interesting question because...
No, I'd love to hear you.
No, go ahead.
No way.
What's that?
No way. You have to go ahead.
It's an interesting question because we're talking about stirring ourselves up through reading, making us question everything, subverting a lot of who we are and what we think about other people. But what about this idea of coming to a place of peace and acceptance? And some people use the word closure. What do you think about that? Can reading lead to those kind of feelings too?
That's a great question. And that is why I was talking about through reading, we come to understanding. And understanding brings us peace. And peace is not bad. I mean, we shouldn't be constantly in a state of subversion, you know. But standing up to difficulties makes that relaxation of mind and heart possible. It is like doing strenuous exercise and then just relaxing, you know, giving in. So these books bring us both question and ambiguity and maybe at times turmoil, but at the same time, they make us understand better and be more at peace with ourselves and with our world.
All right, I have a question from Tanner. What feelings do you experience as a writer reading dangerous literature?
I was a reader before I became a writer. And I always keep the two. I mean, you know, as a writer, I still read as a reader. I don't know if that makes sense, but that is how I do it.
What are you a different reader than you were when you were younger? Are you a different kind of reader now? Do you read differently?
Yeah, I wish I had the spontaneity that I had when I was young. Nowadays, I can't help it. I walk around with, maybe that is the writer in me, but I don't think so. Just underlining books, you know, and sometimes analyzing them, and but the joy, the pure joy of just getting involved and immersed in a story is what I strive for. I want to go back to my childhood.
All right, I have a question from Nazara. Hope I'm pronouncing it right. Apologies if I'm not. This is a related question. How has your definition of reading dangerously changed over time?
Well, I think I explained that a little bit before about how at the beginning, I would go after stories. I was too young to pay attention to what the book is doing to me. I was just taking in what the world was doing to me. And later, I found literature to be actually a solace, a place of where I went to, my portable home. And it was when I went back to the Islamic Republic of Iran that reading dangerously came to the forefront of my mind. Because reading was dangerous. Most of the books that we just go to the bookstore or library and check out or buy over there, they were all banned. And sometimes people could go to jail for them or be flogged for them. So I asked myself, what is it in these books that makes a powerful state to try to eliminate the book and its creator? There must be something dangerous in them if the most powerful men in the world cannot take it, they have to eliminate it. And that was when the idea of reading dangerously came to my mind. And in the United States also, I felt that we want to be comfortable and complacent, and reading didn't allow for that kind of a thing. That there was a different way of being dangerous.
All right, I've got one last question from our audience, from Kay. What is your favorite library memory?
Oh,
that's a great question for our library discussion here.
There are so many memories. I would, in our home in Iran, there were two places where I would go and hide and read. And one was my bedroom, but then my brother would come in and not let me do what I wanted to do. He would, and the other one was library. And I would go to the library and I would lie down by the bookshelves and read my book. And a lot of times for lunch, my mother would be shouting, "Azar, Azar, come and eat." And I was oblivious to what she said. That library, my first experience with library, is still with me. Even the special smell I felt. That library in our home, the first library.
And I've got one last question, because when we talked the other day and I asked you what you were, you know, doing and how much talking you were doing with this book out, you were telling me about all the podcasts that are out there now. We were talking earlier about some indifference you find to books, but you're also at the same time, you're describing an enthusiasm around books and literature.
I know. And you know, that is for me. Books have become a way of connecting and discovering things. Had I not written this book, I would not have known about all these podcasts. And they're all about literature. So there are people from very different backgrounds, with different ideas and opinions, liking different books, who are involved in the promotion of literature. That is something that I didn't know until I wrote a book, you know.
All right. Well, it's been nice to talk to you like this. Azar Nafisi, my friend, congratulations on this. And I guess we throw it back to Jessica now, right?
Thank you both so much for being here. What a beautiful conversation and what an informative one. And it's also wonderful that you're old friends. And just the casual.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you.
the ease with which you talk about your work and books and both of you. It was a lovely conversation, a terrific evening. Thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you, Azar. Thank you, Jeffrey. We're grateful to have you both here, and we're grateful to all of you for tuning in this evening. And on March 17th, we have Stephen Cha and Alex Segura, two wonderful graphic novelists who are young and inspiring, and we look forward to that show. So please join us then, and thank you both so much for being here again, and thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Good night. Bye.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.